Life is too short for shit books. That's the mantra of The Book Alchemist, which celebrates the joy of reading and brilliant books. I'm your host, Heather Sutty. Sarah Sheridan is my guest today, an avid reader. She's also written more than 20 books. We discuss her love of Agatha Christie and she shares the books in her medicine cabinet. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
My pleasure to be here.
Tell me about your love of reading. When did that all sort of start for you?
Oh God, I mean, I was a weird kid in my family because I had two brothers. I still have two brothers. And they were the kind of wee boys you would open the back door in May and stick out a ball of any shape and they would just disappear and come in muddy in about October. So, and I was this weird kid that my mother really didn't know what to do with because I was just obsessed with story and she couldn't give me sort of action things to do. So I would just disappear off and try and read and stuff. My mother was dyslexic, so she couldn't really read. Mm-hmm. You know, she found reading really, really difficult. So I was this absolute mystery to her. My father wasn't around so much. He worked very hard and he was away a lot. And so my mother really took a very bold decision, I suppose, when I was maybe seven, for a dyslexic person who can't read. She took me to the local library. And that was Morningside Library in Edinburgh. And it was like, here is my stuff. These are my
Here's
people.
My place. This is my tribe.
Thank God it was the 70s. Because, you know, today you would never let your seven-year-old walk 20 minutes to the local library on their own. I was Matilda. I'd go down to the library, I'd get books. And I'd come back home with them and just read them. And my mother had this like solution to her problem mm-hmm. for what to do with this kid that was just totally engaged with stuff that she couldn't see and touch and feel. So yeah, I think it's always been there in me. And I think whatever I did, I was always going to do something with story. That my career was always going to be in story, whether it was going to be in film or writing or whatever. It's just, this is where I've landed and I love it.
And you're a very successful author.
Oh, thank you very much.
Now, tell me about the books that you've written.
Well, I've written a lot of different books. I started out writing contemporary commercial fiction for women. So my first novel was called Truth or Dare. They always had, even from the very beginning, even from the first one, some kind of connection from the present to the past. So that's kind of my other obsession is history, like where do we come from and why are we here? And I suppose if my love of reading was encouraged by my mum being brave, my love of history probably came from my dad. He was an antique dealer, he was a diamond dealer, and he would, because mum couldn't read us bedtime stories, if dad was at home, he would tell us bedtime stories, but he didn't read them to us. He would just show us what he'd bought that day and tell us the story of it. And it could be anything. Wow. He could take a tiara out of his pocket, which was good if you're a wee girl. It could be a flintlock. It could be like anything. And he'd say, let me tell you how this was made and who owned it and why it was important to them. So yeah, those kind of stories were very much part of my childhood and that connection to the past. So when I started writing, even if I was writing about the present, the first three novels I wrote were all contemporary fiction. They all had big backstories that went into the past, went into history. And by the time I'd finished the third one, I'd realised, I should be writing history, obviously. So then I started to write historical. And that was quite a big shift to be able to do that. That's not something that happens so much in publishing. I remember telling my editor at the time, I've got this brilliant idea for a historical book. She was horrified because I'd been writing these commercial novels that had been doing quite well.
Yeah.
But it was what I wanted to do. And so that's what I started to write. And I wrote a series of nine murder mystery books, which are very much inspired by my obsession with Agatha Christie. So they're called the Mirabel Bevan Mysteries. And I did some ghostwriting and I wrote historical novels, so I've now written six historical novels and some creative non-fiction as well, including some fiction and non-fiction for TV tie-in. So a couple of ITV series where they have a historical sort of drama going on, they would invite me in to come and write a book that would allow fans of the series to understand the sort of broader historical context of the series.
I was in Topping's bookshop in Edinburgh very recently.
Oh, I love Topping.
My first ever experience, man, I love bookshops. So it's like charity shops. Any city that I go into, I always check out a bookshop. So this time it was Topping's and your book was everywhere.
Yeah, they sold a lot of The Fair Botanist. Is it The Fair Botanist?
Yes.
They're right very close to, obviously, where The Fair Botanist takes place. And it just seems to have really timed a chord with their customers. So sometimes you go into bookshops to do signing and they say, oh, we've got some of your books, and there's 6 or 10. And now when I go into Toppings, there's a couple of hundred books every yes. time for signing. So it seems to have done really well for them, which is like, yay.
Yay, double yay. How much has living in Edinburgh impacted your work, do you think?
Well, actually, I've recently moved to Glasgow and I didn't realise how much living in Edinburgh had impacted my work until I moved away. And I was impacted differently. So, I mean, we're only 50 miles away, but this is a very different city. who was I talking to recently? I was saying, this is a city where people dance in the street to buskers. Yeah. This is a city where there is much more joy. It's like getting the lid off the top of your life. So I think Edinburgh is a great city. It's a creative city. It's not that it's not creative, but it is very conformist. Mm-hmm. And I think by nature, I'm maybe less conformist than Edinburgh. So I feel like my lid has been taken off.
Yay.
I'm having a great time. And I've only just started writing here because I bought a giant flat that needed a lot of work. And we're just kind of getting through that. And I'm able to sort of sit down and start writing again. So I'm really looking forward to what that's going to be like.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to writing, how do you do it? Like, do you have a set process? Like, do you have like a special, I mean, I know you've just moved, but do you have like a certain area where you work? Do you have like a favourite mug? Do you have a ritual? Like, how does it work?
In the ideal world, you do, I think. I like waking up in the morning and I'm full of ideas, and I wake up every morning full of ideas, although recently they've been about like wallpaper and paint and stuff. But when I'm writing, I wake up with, oh my God, that character ought to lose their horse, or maybe somebody ought to fall in love, and I just grab my laptop. My husband's very accommodating, goes and makes me coffee, and I sit in bed usually for 2 or 3 hours in the morning and write about 1,000 words is what I write every day when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit more than that if it's nonfiction. And so I write in bed, which is a bit Barbara Cartland, really. but then once your life is busy and you're maybe in book festival season, so you're traveling a lot, I don't have to write in bed. Mm-hmm. If I get up in the morning and on Friday I'm going to Tain, I'm on a Tain book festival up in the Highlands, I'll be taking stuff with me so that I can write on the move. So mm-hmm. I just, you know, you've got to do it. It's a job. You do it when you do it every day. But in my ideal world, I think my most comfortable routine is just to get up and get on with it.
You mentioned Agatha Christie. Mm. Do you have a favourite Agatha Christie novel that you've read? Or do you just love her?
You've got to love Death on the Nile, really, haven't you? It's quite hard, though. She's very good. She's very bold in the sense that it is really very much about narrative drive, and she's playing inside your head. So that it's a different kind of artistry from something like, say, poetry. I recently sort of put together, I have a study, even though I generally write in bed, but I do other kinds of writing and administering and stuff. And the books in my study are really mostly poetry because they're my medicine cabinet.
Uh-huh,
they okay. are the things, like poetry is really good for refreshing your brain, and part of my job is really just keep my brain fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And so I keep the poetry right by my desk. And Agatha Christie's not like that. Agatha Christie is a distraction. It's an escape. It's full of narrative drive, and it's got that real sense of time and place as well. I mean, she was a contemporary writer.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote about her own time. And that's a slightly different style of writing, but it's in there. And I suppose particularly the 50s, I think even though I was born in the 60s, the 50s is kind of where I come from because it's when it was my parents' heyday.
Mm-hmm.
So it's where my childhood comes from because that was where my parents', you know, era resided, really. So I really like the Marples as well.
When it comes to editing, so let's talk about The Fair Botanist. You know, how many words was that before you passed it on to your editor?
Well, I passed it, she didn't get it just when it was finished. So I think I was about 20, 30,000 words in, and I sent it to Emma, and she came back. She was like, oh, this is a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Well,
and I was like, thanks very much. So I tend to check in at sort of during the process of writing if something's been commissioned,
mm-hmm.
And just let them see it, make sure it's what they want. And then they can come back and say things like, oh, I love this character in particular, or I didn't understand this bit, or, mm-hmm. Just have a chat about it as it goes along in these large-ish chunks. And then about, I think it's about 100,000 words long. So I think I delivered it at 30, delivered it at 60, and delivered it at 100. So when you deliver the 100, they've already had input mm-hmm. into it. So you're writing along the line that they're mm-hmm. they're happy with as well.
When it came to the art for the cover, which I love, by the way, mm-hmm. How much of a say did you have in the cover art?
They ask you, but they don't have to do whatever you ask. So the cover was drawn of the Fair Botanist by a woman called Charlotte Day, whose speciality is drawing botanicals on gin bottles.
It's beautiful. I love it.
And you can see that actually when you mm-hmm. look at the book and look at like some of these botanical gin bottles, you're like, oh yeah, I see what she did there. Mm-hmm. And actually she has drawn the cover of the next book, which is out in February, is set in Glasgow. Victorian Glasgow, called The Secrets of Blythewood Square. And again, it's a botanical cover. And so we waited for Charlotte. She was very busy. And they said, no, we want to wait and get her to do it because we feel like this is such a good pairing.
So when you're writing The Secrets of Blythewood Square, which I'm intrigued already, because everybody knows that Blythewood Square has quite a dark history. And my mum also used to work for the Automobile Association.
Oh, so you know Blythewood Square.
Yeah. So where did the idea and the inspiration for your new book come from?
Well, we'd had this big success with the Fair Botanist already by the time I was pitching in for it and we were talking about what I was going to do next. And I am quite nonconformist. Somebody else, I suppose, would have said, I'll write another book set in Edinburgh in 1822. But I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to explore other areas. And I tend to go where the history is really interesting. So in 1846, the freed slave, Frederick Douglass, came on a lecture tour to Scotland. In fact, he didn't have his manumission papers. He wasn't really free, but he was in the process of that. And he picked a fight with the Free Kirk. Okay. And so 1846 in Glasgow was a really interesting place. And the other thing that I was really interested in about the sort of mid-1840s was the genesis of photography in Scotland. This was the first time that people were taking photographs. It was very expensive. It was considered very difficult. It was a very technical process. But, there had been a few studios set up. And because the process had been patented in England, it didn't develop in the same way there. In Scotland, it was like it just took off. And so I was kind of interested because I'm always interested in female history of, who were the early female photographers and can we find them? Mm-hmm. And so that those two things came together for me and I was like, this has to happen in Glasgow and it has to happen. One of the main characters has to be a female photographer and looking at that genesis of the female eye, why do women see things differently from the way that men see things? And what would that have been like in 1846? So the story contains two main characters, two main female characters. One of them is an heiress who lives on Blythewood Square and she inherits a house and a fortune and all the rest of it. She's a member of the Free Kirk and she discovers behind the wall of one of her father's studies an inconvenient collection of erotic art that he had. And she's horrified. She's a good girl. This tumbles her father in her brain. She cannot imagine what this is like. And she has to get rid of it. But she doesn't know how to because she's a lady.
Okay.
So she befriends this photographer who's called Ellery McHale, who has set up a photographic studio, the first female photographer in Glasgow, who's fictional, on St. Enoch Square. And Ellery takes a photograph of her maid showing her ankle. Oh. And this causes a quite the stir because showing your ankle is wild madness in the era of 1840s women's bodies. And so these two women have this in common and they help each other out in different ways.
I read recently, very quickly on Twitter, it was like a tweet that flew by me. Kate Winslet is working on a film about Lee Miller who...
Oh yeah, I saw that as well.
Did you see that? Yeah. So it's really interesting that you've chosen that particular subject because when I think about it, there are hardly any very well-known female photographers. I mean, is it Annie Leibovitz?
Yeah, I mean, there are now, there are more, but yeah. I mean, then there just weren't any. I found one. When I started to write the book, it was still locked down and the archives were all closed, but once I'd got 40,000 or 50,000 words in, I managed to get into the Portrait Gallery in Edinburgh. They have very early photographs there. They have David Octavius Hill and Robert Adamson, who are the real early pioneers at Rock House in Edinburgh in the early 1840s. And they start taking calotypes. And they have a female assistant called Jessie Mann. And there are a few photographs that have both Robert and David Octavius in them. So we were like, well, who took those photographs? Mm-hmm. And Jessie seems to have done quite a bit of developing the photographs. So she was kind of integral to the way the studio works, but is credited nowhere. Mm. So that's quite interesting. So I actually made Ellery, my female photographer, is Jessie Mann's cousin, because that just seemed like a really nice connection. Yeah. So the book starts in Rock House in this photographic studio in Edinburgh, with Ellery deciding she's going to come to Glasgow.
History is fascinating, and I'll be honest, I don't read a lot of historical fiction because I find sometimes my brain can't cope with all the information. But I recently went to the National Portrait Gallery. I went to see the Grace and Perry exhibition.
Oh, yeah.
But then I went to the other museum, and the one that you were talking about, and I was mesmerised by the range of art, you know, dates back to like 1600. And you just think, wow, you know, but you're right, where are all the women?
Yeah, always where are the women? There are a few women in the National Portrait Gallery. There is a bust actually in the hall of Susan Ferrier, who was a Edinburgh writer, early 19th century Edinburgh writer. So there are some women in there, but not enough. Mm. Not going to lie, Heather.
When you were growing up, did you always want to be an author?
No, not at all. I was a reader and I was obsessed with story. And I honestly think I probably could have gone into film, or I could have done production, or anything to do with story I would have been into. Mm-hmm. But I married my first husband. I had my daughter, Molly. And when Molly was very little, she and I separated. And I was really struggling to do my full-time job at that time, which was going out to work and looking after this baby. She was still really very young, toddler really. And I thought, I must find something I can do at home. Mm-hmm. And I literally thought, maybe I'll write a book.
Wow.
And so I'd done a degree. My degree was in English Lit from Trinity in Dublin. So it was, you know, and I'd been a lifelong reader. I thought, I'm just going to give this a try. If it doesn't work, I'll get another job. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible idea, by the way. If anyone listening wants to write a book, it's probably not the way to do it. But I quit my job. And I decided to write about 1,000 words a day. I thought, if I write 1,000 words a day, novels, technically novels, 70,000 words minimum, I'll write every day for 14, 15 weeks and I'll have a novel. Again, maybe not the best plan, but it worked for me. Mm-hmm. So I ended up with a novel that was 73,500 words long, and I literally just sent it anywhere I could think of, and it got taken up. I got my first offer in the first 3 weeks.
Wow.
Which again is very rare, doesn't really, yeah, like there's huge competition. I was just very jammy, so.
Jammy, jammy, jammy.
Yeah, totally. I say that. Yeah, I tell that story at book festivals and the whole of the front row look at you like, wow, I hate you. Because very often at book festivals, people come because they want to write. Uh-huh. And so you tell that story and people are like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened to you, because it was really very lucky.
And sometimes it's all about timing, isn't it? Mm. I mean, maybe if you had waited till Molly was a wee bit older and decided to do a different job, you know, the stars might not have aligned.
Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different thing, isn't it? There's lots of good writers out there that aren't getting published because their stuff just doesn't chime with what is needed in a certain publishing list right now. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not only talent that gets you by. There is an element of magical luck. And the thing is, society changes all the time, and what they're looking for changes slightly all the time. And so you can't decide to write a book that you think they're going to want.
Yeah.
Because that changes every month, pretty much. Uh-huh. So it's a kind of magical process.
When you're not researching, because I imagine a lot of your time is taking up with the joy of research.
Yeah, well, I do a lot of reading still, certainly, yeah.
So what books do you have on the go at the moment?
Oh, well, actually, at the moment, I am knee-deep in books about Glasgow history because I'm interested in where we moved to in Glasgow. So we moved to Blyswood Hill, so I'm reading some books, and books of old maps are all over my desk of Glasgow. So just looking at how that area developed, mm-hmm. and what it was like before. I live in a Victorian building, but that area was developed in the Georgian era as well. So Glasgow's really interesting. It's so different from Edinburgh. In Edinburgh, they conserve everything. You know, there have been some buildings that have gone all down, but largely in Edinburgh, you conserve, you conserve, you conserve. In Glasgow, you put in new. And so when you walk down our street, there are buildings that were built very recently, right down to buildings that were built, the original buildings that were there in the 1820s. Mm-hmm. So I'm learning a lot about that because I'm not writing at the moment, so I don't need to be reading those things. So yeah, actually my reading at the moment, a lot of it is maps.
Okay.
And stuff around Glasgow history.
And when it comes to completely switching off, I know you mentioned poetry earlier. Mm. Are there any other types of books that you just, that are your comfort read, that are your go-to, that perhaps you read many years ago, maybe picked them up again during lockdown, or, you know, what's your kind of go-to comfort read?
Well, I've lots, actually. I've quite a few books that I think are really good. I love Water Music by T.C. Boyle. It's a historical novel set between 1799 and 1803. Partly in Scotland, partly in Africa. It's a very, very good book. It's a book that's just bubbling with textual history. It's quite a shocking book as well because it's quite violent, some of it. Really enjoy that. And I go back to that and read that periodically. And then the short stories of Lorna Moon, who is a Scottish writer who went out to work in early Hollywood. And she wrote these short stories actually about a fictional village called Drumherty, can't remember the name of the village. But she came from Strachan in Aberdeenshire, and it's really about Strachan.
Okay.
This book got banned from Strachan Library when it came out. But she has this great short story style, which is just about ramping up the tension. And she tells these stories that are just really very little happens, but the tension is huge of these people's lives in this village in Aberdeenshire. And you can see how she became an amazing screenwriter. So I love her short stories. Other short stories, I love Damien Runyon, who's an American writer who writes about the same kind of era in the 1920s and 1930s. Very wry stories about American gangsters. They're really good fun. I like Cavalier and Clay by Michel Chabon. And I'm trying to read in French a little bit at the moment as well. I was very good at French when I was younger. My favourite uncle lived in Paris. Of course, he was my favourite. And I stayed there for quite a while. And so I had really good French. And then because I hadn't been back, my French went downhill. And so I've been polishing it up recently and reading a few French novels as well. So just to try and bring up my language skills there, because it's about having a wide lexicon.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the great things that we have in Scotland. You know, we have three languages. So even if you're only using a few words of Scots or a little bit of Gaelic here and there, you've got more words than everyone else. Mm-hmm. So that's quite important as a writer.
One book that I read about a year ago, which I recommended in my book group, is by a French author. I didn't read the French version, unfortunately. But it's by an author called Valerie Perrin.
Yes.
And she wrote Freshwater for Flowers.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you read that?
I haven't read it. It's actually on my desk.
It's exquisite.
Oh, I can't wait. Now I'm going to go home, going to dump the maps, and I'm going to pick up that because it's literally just sitting there on my desk.
It's funny. Yeah, I don't know how I discovered it. It's funny sometimes, you know, you come across books and you can't remember how you find them. You know, sometimes I'll maybe see like a book in a magazine and I'll think, oh, and then I'll forget about it and then it'll pop up somewhere else. And I can't remember how I found Valerie Perrin. But oh my gosh, I loved it. It's beautiful, beautifully written.
I'll message you, I'll be like, yeah, you were right.
Or... please do. So you mentioned book festivals earlier. How much do you enjoy the promotional aspect of your work?
Oh, I mean, every writer's got to love talking about that, haven't they? It's really nice. And when people come, I mean, that's one of the joys with The Fair Botanist is that it's been out for 2.5 years now. And almost every day, there are people coming back saying, I liked it for this, or I loved it for that, whatever. So that interaction with readers and speaking to readers and getting reader feedback is really great. And I'm not a shy speaker. I remember the first time I was ever at a book festival. This is like 1997 or 8 or something. I did at the Edinburgh Book Festival. It was my first book festival for that first book I wrote, Truth or Dare.
Wow.
And I was on with Isla Durer.
Who's Isla Durer?
She wrote a whole load of books. She's...
I was thinking of Isla St Clair, but I think she was a game show host.
No, it's not Isla St Clair. Anyway, whoever she was, I was on with her. We were on a duo on the stand, and she was being sick outside the author's tent.
Oh, with nerves.
Because she was so nervous. And I remember thinking, why are you doing this? Like, what are you doing? Like, if you don't like doing it, don't do it. She was like, oh, I'm always like this. And I was like, you've done this more than once. This is terrible. So I love talking about what I do and chatting to folk and hearing what people have to say and all that kind of stuff. So I really enjoy it. And we're lucky in Scotland. We have like over 50 book festivals. In the north of England, there's a whole load of book festivals as well. So I tend to focus on doing those ones.
I have never been to a book festival.
Do you want to come on Friday? I'm going up north. Join me in the car. up to 10. I'm doing 10 on Friday.
It's funny. I think probably the reason that I've never been to a book festival is purely my own insecurity, and in that I think that it's going to be pretentious or overtly intellectual or a bit kind of snobbish. I mean, I've got friends who are authors who've been at the Hay Festival and Edinburgh International Book Festival, blah, blah, blah. But I just, for some reason, I've just never been drawn to it.
Well, if you want to go, I'll chum you. That's what I'm saying. They're all different. It's really interesting as well, because some book festivals are like a few people who've got together in a wee village somewhere and said, we should have a book festival. Uh-huh. And they invite, you know, four authors over a weekend or something, and it's really small. And then other ones like Edinburgh is obviously the biggest book festival in the world. So it is huge, and it has, you know, it covers everything from genre fiction to poetry to, you know, nonfiction. It's got everything. There's usually 800 or 900 authors on. You know, it's a massive, massive endeavor. So they're all different, and they are all characterized by the place that they are set. And there are some that are literary. You know, sometimes I look at, I don't like the word literary, because I feel like literary makes people feel exactly what you're talking about. If it's a literary festival, it's not available. Like, it's being literary is about judging the quality of something and not whether you enjoy it or not. So I prefer the idea of a book festival to a literary festival. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a more accessible way of, you know, sharing ideas about books. But I think it probably it's about finding the right book festival for you, because they are really different. Mm. You know, they are really different. For me, it's all about, like, I'm not really a critic, a natural critic. For me, the greatest joy really is, you know, that moment when you're reading and you've forgotten what day it is. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you finish the book and you're like, is it light outside? You cannot remember. That is the ideal experience of reading. And I don't really care how people get that. That's like an exercise for your brain. That is mind expanding. That's an important thing to do for you. And it doesn't matter if you get that from reading manga comics, or you get that from reading, you know, Jared Manley Hopkins's poetry, or you get that from, you know, wherever you get it, it doesn't really matter. The thing is, it's the thing that works for your brain, and that can change.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I randomly do is I'll read cookbooks.
My mum loves cookbooks. She lives near Toppings in Edinburgh. Does she? And she just goes up there, sits down, reads a whole load of cookbooks, and leaves. She thinks there's a fucking library in there.
It's so funny, because I don't, you know, I'm not a big baker, I'm not a whiz in the kitchen, but I just love the way they're, because I think there's a real art form to producing a wonderful cookbook, you know, because it's not just about the photography, it's about the delicious descriptions, and that I find that just completely switches my brain off.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I get you. I mean, I have a load of cookbooks.
I mean, they're ornaments in the kitchen. They're not.
You're not really cooking out of those cookbooks.
No. So I imagine that you do a lot of traveling.
Yeah, I did used to. I haven't really since COVID. My world has contracted somewhat. So actually not so much right now. I discovered my inner introvert during COVID. And my inner introvert is now well and truly out the box. And I'm a bit like, I don't know if I want to go out of the house at all.
Yeah, can totally relate to that. Do you have a favourite library in any city in the world? And have you joined a Glasgow library?
I haven't joined, but I've been to the Mitchell a few times. They have very good Glasgow, because I've been looking into Glasgow. So they have the kind of Glasgow City Archive there. So I've been delving into the street where I live and what was on it, and you know, what the architect's original plans were and how they differ from what got built and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that would have to be my favourite. And it's also my local, because I'm city centre.
Yeah.
So it's the local library. And then the other side of the city centre, you have the Glasgow Women's Library, which is just amazing. The resources there and the support there and the accessibility that's possible in there as well. I think quite often women feel what you were talking about with book festivals, but with libraries. Mm-hmm. And the Glasgow Women's Library is run for women. So it's much more accessible. And it's really important resource as well. So they have all kinds of interesting stuff in the archive there about, for example, suffragists and suffragettes and how that played out, particularly in Scotland. They have a lot of archive material. And they also have things like a roller derby, female roller derby archive that they have all sort of information relating to that. So lots of stuff, quite quirky, some of it, which I really like.
My final question, because I could chat to you all day because you're a fascinating guest.
Oh, thank you so much.
Have you passed your love of reading on to your daughter, Molly?
This is really interesting. So Molly has a kind of dyslexia as well. So she finds reading really difficult. She's a visual person.
Okay.
So I've passed my love of story onto her, certainly, and she has that innately, I think, within her wee self. But she is not a reader so much as I am. And she would certainly not tend to read fiction. She would read nonfiction if she was reading at all. But her sense of visual identity is massive. She works in that industry and she's just amazing. And actually, I've learned a lot from her about visual stories, how to tell visual stories, which are one of the key storytelling sort of ways that we tell stories in our culture, both online, but also on television and in film and things.
One very final question, because I've already passed my last question. If there's one book that you've written that you're most fond of, that you would recommend, that if the people wanted to get a sense of who you are and your work, which one would it be and why?
Well, it's got to be The Fair Botanist, in that that's the latest one that's out. And so that's where I have most recently been.
Mm-hmm.
You do learn and change as you go along. So one of my jobs next is actually a little re-edit on a book that was out maybe 10 years ago. And you change, you learn, you get better, hopefully. Hope I'm getting better. And so I'm going to go back. I've arranged to go back and just make a few changes to it because I feel like it really needs a bit of tightening up, that story. So yeah, it would have to be probably The Fair Botanist, or I mean, I suppose people could have a look at Where Are the Women, which is that time I remapped Scotland according to women's history.
Bet you got pelters for that.
It was great. The emails were great. I mean, random people are hilarious. Yeah, so that's another great book that might be interesting to people about where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's a lot of hidden history in there, a lot of reframing how we came to be where we are today. And I mean, that book, to be really honest, we could talk about that book for another 45 minutes if you like. It radicalized me, like researching that book, because I knew there were some women who weren't getting the spotlight. And I was like, there's over 1,000 women here. This is crazy on my research list.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of people that have just been forgotten,
mm-hmm.
and their achievements not credited. And we come from that. I was actually writing an essay yesterday for a publication that's coming out with the university in Edinburgh, and remembering being a kid in Edinburgh. That's kind of nice because that's where we started when we were talking, me being a kid, and walking down streets with my brothers, and my brothers see people who look like them on plinths.
Mm-hmm.
Whose achievements are honoured. So you can have achievements and you get a statue. That's something that's normal, or a street named after you. It's normal if you're a guy. We don't have that as women.
Mm-hmm.
Girls always feel they have to be the first.
Yeah.
And so researching Where Are the Women was kind of quite a moving experience for me, because I was realising we don't have to be the first. We come from this amazing legacy of our grannies and great-grannies and great-great-great-grannies. And we must remember to remember them.
Sarah, thank you so much. That was brilliant.
It's such a nice to chat to you.
Come back.
Anytime.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please take 30 seconds to rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps. New episodes drop every Thursday. Thanks so much for listening.